You're tuned to Sounds of Dissent, WZBC in Newton. My name is John Grebe. In just a moment, we'll speak with Joy Gordon, the author of an article in this month's Harper's Magazine, The UN Is Us, exposing Saddam Hussein's silent partner. She says the Bush administration was still reeling from the revelations about Abu Ghraib prison this year when supporters of the president, President Bush, suddenly took note of a dramatic new scandal involving Iraq. William Safire said, the richest ripoff in world history, fraud and deception that probably resulted in the deaths of thousands of Iraqis through malnutrition, according to Republican Congressman Ralph Hall. We'll ask her about how that controversy ensued and how much the United States actually knew about it. Joy Gordon, welcome to Sounds of Dissent on WZBC.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your article in this month's Harper's Magazine, subtitled Exposing Saddam Hussein's Silent Partner, which you point out was the United States. Your article, I just read the introduction to it, and one headline in the New York Times, How Hussein Stole Billions Under the Eye of the United Nations Oil for Food Program. In the hearings that were chaired in July, Congressman Ralph Hall spoke of, you say, quote, the trail of corruption unfolding on the world stage, end quote, and introduced a speaker whose book on the UN is entitled Inside the Asylum. So Republican congressmen have found this recent opportunity to attack the United Nations and Kofi Annan, although it got a little bit out of control about a week or two ago. We spoke with Phyllis Bennis briefly about this last week, and by the end of the week, the Bush administration was backing Kofi Annan, saying, whoa, boys, we need this man in power in the United Nations. I wonder if you could outline, just to pick it up there for a moment, about that kind of strange shift, or perhaps it's a kind of a good cop, bad cop role in a way of discrediting the United Nations that the United States has undertaken under the Bush administration, at least.
Well, I think what's happened is that the Bush administration overplayed its hand a bit. So we've seen a total of, rather remarkably, 9 sets of congressional investigations that have taken place since last spring. And all of them are just nothing, almost nothing, but attacks of every imaginable sort on the UN, the UN in general, on Kofi Annan and son, the whole Oil for Food program. And if you read the transcripts of these, nearly every witness, and they have the most right-wing witnesses you can imagine, go on and on, and does the UN have any future at all? This is just nothing but fraud and corruption. One congressman says, you know, children died because of this program. In the United States, we call that murder. Things that just have no grounding in fact. The only way you can describe it is a feeding frenzy, and the press was all over it as well. The Wall Street Journal was doing the same. New York Times reporters who were covering this were doing the same, as though the only question is, how corrupt is the entire UN? Does it have any function left at all? As though that's the only question. What none of these investigations touched on, rather astonishingly, is certain basic obvious facts about how the program works. So it was very common to hear, excuse me, there is no accountability in this program. There was no monitoring, no oversight. Well, there were 7 levels of monitoring and oversight of the most elaborate sort you can imagine. There were something like over 100 audits of how the money was handled. No money within the program ever went through the hands of the Iraqi government. That was by design. Every item that the Iraqi government purchased in import contracts had to be approved at multiple levels, including by every single member of the Security Council. Every oil deal had to be approved by every single member of the Security Council. Iraq could not sell a tanker of oil without every member of the council, including the U.S., approving the price, the date, the terms of every single sale of oil. So the fact that there was this, feeding frenzy is the only thing I can come up with, except maybe witch hunt, to describe this sort of roiling kind of frothing anti-UN attack It certainly culminated in Norm Coleman calling for Kofi Annan's resignation a couple weeks ago. And that, you know, was only surprising that it took that long for the Bush administration to send up a trial balloon of that sort. What happened in response was really interesting, which was, I think, what was not expected by the Bush administration, which is a lot of people coming to the defense of the UN, and in particular by specifically saying, look, many of the things that you're accusing the UN of, you have to break down and say, what had to do with the Secretary General? What had to do with the Security Council? Because they're different entities. Security Council is made up of 15 member states. The five permanent members, U.S., U.K., France, Russia, China, have extraordinary power. They have this. They're permanent members, and they have veto power. Within the Security Council as well, the U.S. in particular for the last decade, in the absence of the Soviet Union, has held enormous sway. So what a lot of people now, literally in the last week and a half, are saying is, who exactly was responsible for which of these things? Because if you don't even have to dig deep. If you do so much as go on to the UN's website, what you'll see, it takes you 30 seconds to do it, is a very clear explanation of who is responsible for what. And what's very clear is the basic structure of the program, the basic policies of the program, were put in place by the Security Council, not by the Secretary General.
And the Security Council is, consists of just a few nations in the world, including the United States, with a tremendous amount of enforcement power, much more than the other 180-odd members of the United Nations who do not have Security Council permanent membership status.
Sure. And remember, the way that the UN Charter works is that it's only the Security Council that can respond to aggression, breaches of the peace, or threats against the peace, and only then, and only the Security Council can use military force, or sever diplomatic relations, or use economic measures like sanctions. So, first of all, the Security Council itself is counter-majoritarian. The General Assembly, which is the democratic part of the United Nations, has no power at all to decide to use force against the country or to respond to aggression. So already you have only these 15 nations. And then within that, if any one of the members wanted, for example, well, to introduce a resolution, let's say hypothetically, saying that the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq was an act of aggression, that it was a violation of international law and was an act of aggression. Let's just say that that's a position that someone on the council wanted to take and that they wanted to propose a resolution condemning the U.S. for that and suggesting military action on behalf of the U.N. to stop that. Obviously, the U.N. will veto anything that goes against its interests. So the result is, the five permanent members have a kind of absolute impunity. Nothing can ever be done by the UN Security Council against these five or anyone who is an ally of theirs or a client state they wish to protect, because they can simply veto anything that they choose that goes against their interests.
My guest is Joy Gordon, who's published an article in this month's Harper's Magazine called "The UN Is Us, Exposing Saddam Hussein's Silent Partner." Joy Gordon, you point out that the heart of the General Accounting Office, that's the United States government, incidentally, the accusation that they published in April is that from 1997 through 2004, the former Iraqi regime acquired $10.1 billion in illegal revenues related to the oil for food program. And then there's the Dwelfer report commissioned by the CIA with more details about this. And then you say, given the elaborate safeguards built into the oil for food program, critics have argued, how could such a theft occur without complicity? Outline, if you could, the way that the United States was involved in the United Nations Oil for Food Program. How would the United States have been watching this stuff carefully?
Well, let's talk about how these illicit funds would have taken place under the nose of the U.S., or to be even stronger about it, with explicit U.S. knowledge and approval. So one claim is there's all this smuggling. I think the reports come up with different numbers. One says $6 billion in smuggling. One says something else in smuggling. But let's say it's billions in smuggling. And of that, there's maritime smuggling. So tankers of oil are coming out of Iraq, and, you know, maybe they're going through Iranian waters, but in any case, it's on the high seas. So there's, quote, a UN force, the Multinational Interception Force, charged with interdicting maritime smuggling. Well, this UN force actually consists of a Security Council resolution, I think it's 665, that just invites member nations. Essentially, if you happen to have vessels in the area, we invite you to interdict smuggling if the occasion should arise, something like that. So it doesn't create an entity within the UN. It doesn't have some entity that's subordinate to the Secretary General. It's just this kind of open invitation. So the result is that the U.S. Fifth Fleet, and almost only the U.S. Fifth Fleet, chooses to respond to this. So this multinational interception force is, in fact, this kind of loose-knit coalition. That is, at every point in time from 1991 on, under the command of a U.S. Rear Admiral from the Fifth Fleet or a U.S. Vice Admiral from the Fifth Fleet, no one else at any point. Nearly every ship at every point is a U.S. vessel. So in 2001, it was, I think there were 90 U.S. ships involved. There were maybe, four British ships, and a handful of other countries contributed a ship for a month or 2 months. So it's overwhelmingly consisting of the U.S. It's explicitly under the command of the U.S. At no point are they reporting to the Secretary General. No point does the Secretary General have any control over this at all. So I'm not suggesting they didn't do their job. In fact, they did hundreds of boardings and and diverted hundreds of ships. But it is the case that if you say, how did all this smuggling happen on the high seas under the nose of the U.N., well, it wasn't under the nose of the U.N., it was under the nose of the U.S. Fifth Fleet. Take another example. The overland smuggling, which was to Jordan and Turkey, as well as a couple of other nations, but by far the bulk of it was to Jordan. So in 1991, the Security Council takes note of the fact that Jordan is engaging in illicit trade with Iraq. It's the Security Council's job to respond to sanctions violations and enforce the sanctions. Instead, they simply take note that this is going on and decide to do nothing. Jordan, obviously, is the U.S.'s major ally in the Arab world. The same thing happens with Turkey. Clearly, we need Turkey for military access to their bases. And so what happens, both under the current Bush administration and under the Clinton administration, is that every year, starting in, 1994, they submit waivers to Congress waiving the imposition of any penalties on Turkey and Jordan who are openly engaging in violation of the sanctions regime. So those are a couple of examples of how these things took place that are now being laid at the feet of Kofi Annan, but in fact were explicitly U.S. responsibility or explicitly approved and supported by the U.S.
You point out in the article, and I should mention again, we're speaking with Joy Gordon about her article in the December issue of Harper's Magazine, The United Nations is Us, that you point out Saddam Hussein smuggled $6 billion worth of oil out of Iraq, according to the General Accounting Office of the United States, a lot of it via tanker in the Persian Gulf. But the United Nations Multilateral Interception Force charged with interdicting that kind of smuggling turns out not to be a United Nations operation at all. It came about when the Security Council, in a resolution in 1991, inviting any UN member country to interdict Iraqi oil smuggling in the Gulf if the occasion arose. Tell us more about what ensued from that.
What ensued from the...
Well, you point out that what happened was a collection of ships from various nations under the command of a United States officer from the Fifth Fleet, which you were mentioning earlier. I think it points up in a particular way that the military was involved in observing a lot of this.
Or certainly the U.S. Navy was. I'll give you another example of a U.S. role in explicitly allowing the illicit funds that we're now blaming the U.N. for. So there are these import contracts. And under the Oil for Food program, it came to $30-odd billion total over from the history of the program from 97 to 2003. And by the way, the total amount of goods that actually got into Iraq under the Oil for Food program came out to, I think it was $190 per person per year, which is less than the per capita income of Haiti, which is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. So this was not a program that was generous to the Iraqi people in any regard at all. And the U.S. fought intensely to keep ceilings on it and to impede the goods from, to impede basic humanitarian goods from going in every way. But let's go back to the smuggling and the kickbacks. So Iraq, it turns out that Iraqi civil servants were instructed to tack on an extra 5 to 10% on all of the import contracts. And this was not known until the fall of the regime, when UN and occupation officials were interviewing Iraqi government officials and learned of this in interviews. There had been some suspicions that this was the case, but nothing that could be demonstrated. So after the fall of the regime, this becomes clear. And then there is this huge outpouring again of attacks on the UN. How could you have allowed them to put these 5 or 10% increases on and not catch them? How could you have been so incompetent, or even incompetence probably doesn't account for it, there must be some corruption? Well, in fact, what happens is that for 5% or 10%, it's not at all easy to discern. If you think about anything that you buy, the fluctuation can easily be 5% or 10%, and it's not obvious that somebody is engaging in fraud. What did happen is that where it was clear that there was some fraud, or that the prices were so high it was likely that some kickbacks were going to take place, the UN staff brought that to the attention of the Security Council. This happened on more than 70 occasions, 70 times. The UN staff, which did not have the power to stop the contracts or approve them, they only had the power to tell the Security Council members, and those Security Council members had the power to stop contracts or approve them. So 70-odd times, UN staff go to the Security Council and they say, on this particular contract, the numbers are off the charts, something fishy is going on here, do you want to block the contract? And on none of those occasions did the U.S. choose to do that. On every single occasion, given documentation that fraud was going on, the U.S. approved the contract. So, again, we're looking at a situation where what's happened is that the role of the Security Council is conflated with the role of the Secretary General, and it's as though when we say the U.N. failed to act on this, that the blame ends up being laid at the feet of the Secretary General, when in fact that was simply not within his authority at any point.
We're speaking with Joy Gordon, the author of the article in Harper's Magazine, exposing Saddam Hussein's silent partner. Joy Gordon, just curious, in your review of the press coverage of this issue, if you could give us your kind of sense, a synopsis or so about how this issue's been portrayed in the major press that most people have access to in the United States in the last few weeks.
Sure. It's certainly, I would say, up until 2 weeks ago, it was just vitriolic, undifferentiated attacks. The UN is an institutional failure. Kofi Annan, you know, should step down. How could this travesty have been allowed to take place? Does the UN have a future in the world? And I think we're still seeing lots and lots of that. What I think is the real scandal is actually not that this amount of money ended up in the wrong hands. In the history of economic sanctions, there's always leaks. There's always stuff that gets in and stuff that gets out, no matter how tight you make the sanctions. To me, what really needs to be addressed is, and I think it's Ralph Hall that said, by depriving Iraqis of money for food, we call this murder. Well, the real scandal to my mind is who committed these, who was responsible for these large-scale deaths in Iraq under the sanctions. And for that, you really have to look again at the Security Council and in particular the U.S. So of the first year of the program, food and medicine got through. There wasn't much money for that. There was nothing controversial. No one blocked anything. What was decided pretty quickly is that food and medicine aren't enough to run a country. So, for example, it doesn't matter if you get the food into the country if there aren't trucks to deliver it. It doesn't matter if you get medicine in if you don't have electricity and cold storage to maintain the cold chain to keep the medicines good by the time they're delivered. What then happened is it was clear that Iraq needed infrastructure. It's an industrialized country. It needs electricity to run every aspect of the country. That's when you saw the U.S. starting to intervene very aggressively to block critical humanitarian imports at every single level. The U.S. initially blocked $150 million of goods, and that number grew and grew and grew. By July of 2002, the U.S. had placed $5 billion of critical humanitarian goods on hold and was not, with no sign at all that that was going to be released. And when you do that, and specifically the things that we blocked, was everything relating to electricity and many things relating to infrastructure, construction, transportation, telecommunications. And if you look at the mass of child mortality, UNICEF figures as of 99 were that 500,000 children under 5 were dead in Iraq as a result of the sanctions, who would not have been dead under Saddam Hussein's regime prior to the sanctions. And that's primarily waterborne diseases and malnutrition. And if you look at Iraq trying to buy, for example, water and sewage treatment plants, what you'll see at every point is the U.S., for example, allowing Iraq to buy the sewage treatment plant and blocking the electrical generator necessary to run it. And if you want to say who was responsible for this massive child mortality, you have to look at, again, at the U.S. The U.K. did not even join us in this. The U.S. was absolutely alone, absolutely acting unilaterally in blocking literally billions and billions of dollars of critical humanitarian supplies that were directly related to massive mortality rates in Iraq.
Joy Gordon, thank you so much for joining us today on Sounds of Dissent.
Well, thank you for having me.
Joy Gordon is a Fairfield University professor. Her article in the December issue of Harper's Magazine is entitled "The UN is Us, Exposing Saddam Hussein's Silent Partner." You're tuned to WZBC in Newton.